Welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists and opinion makers that bridge our two worlds. My name's Chad O'Carroll and I'll be your host today. In this episode of Korean Context, we spoke to Korean-American actor James Kyson Lee, known most for his role of Japanese character Ando Masahashi from the hit TV series Heroes. In our conversation, we spoke about what it was like moving to the United States aged 10, what he thought about the Hallyu, or Korean Wave as it's known in English, his idea of the prospects for US-Korea relations moving forward, what motivated his initial interest in acting, and purely out of interest, what his first on-screen kiss was like. I started my conversation with James by asking him to explain what it had been like growing up as a Korean immigrant in New York City and adapting to the new culture.
It was a huge culture shock. The only thing I knew about the States at the time was through television, and I think there were about three or four American shows that were airing in Korea, Different Strokes, The Hulk, Knight Rider, and they're all dubbed in Korean, which made me think as a child that in America they spoke Korean. So I knew Michael Jackson and I knew Disneyland. So my idea of America was that we're going to come here and I was going to go to Disneyland and hang out with Michael Jackson and speak Korean. So obviously that dream crashed pretty fast. And I remember my first month in fifth grade, because I didn't speak the language, I got into like three altercations just from miscommunication. And so it was especially growing up in New York City, it's such a diverse place, and you know, you have to learn to adapt pretty quickly. So yeah, it was a huge change.
And what did you miss most about Korea when you first arrived? If you can remember.
Well, I remember the food being so different, you know, and obviously when you're growing up in Korea, you grew up on Korean food, and so that was a big change. I had to learn to adapt to being a stranger in a foreign land, you know, and what the common language for me was, it became sports, American football, and we played a lot of handball and baseball. And so the kids that I was not necessarily getting along with right away soon became my friends through sports. That sort of became the common language.
So you'd have arrived in New York City, was it around the early 90s?
No, it was 86.
So not long after that, Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing was filmed.
Yeah.
Growing up in New York City around that time, do you recognize any of the sort of racial difficulties there were between the various communities in New York at the time? Because, you know, the Korean Americans and African Americans in that film, there's a lot of tension between them. And does that seem reflective of how things were at the time in New York City?
Yeah, I think I was in grade school when it came out, or junior high school. But I totally remember us talking about it with friends, and you know, especially if you grew up in Brooklyn, you know that scene. And of course, some things have to be dramatized or exaggerated, you know, for sake of the movie. But my life was very rooted in the immigrant blue-collar family experience. So survival was always a huge thing, and people not knowing how to communicate to each other, trying to work things out. So you're dealing with a lot of tension and conflict, and New York is a kind of place where there are a lot of minority groups trying to survive at the same time. So it is a mix of collaboration and competition. So, you know, it was definitely an interesting place to grow up, but I'm glad I did, because it really taught me how to adapt and how to analyze things pretty quickly. I mean, there's a cliche that if you could survive in New York, you could survive anywhere, but it's sort of true.
All right, so as you may know, I'm the director of communications at KI, and I read that you used to study communications. So why did you choose to abandon following in my footsteps to go for something like acting?
Yeah, you know, my my first love was the NBA. So I thought I was going to go work for ESPN or something related to basketball after school. But my last year in Boston, which where I was studying at, I tried out some improv comedy. It just totally awakened something within me, you know. And, you know, I was really curious about it. It was very liberating. And so it planted a seed in my head, I guess. And because I grew up in the East Coast my whole life, I felt like I needed to go explore life a little bit more in an unfamiliar setting, which was the West Coast, you know. And it became Los Angeles. And that was a big change, too, because, I mean, I sold my used car, and I had $1,800. I bought a one-way ticket, and I came out with one suitcase. And my first night in LA, I ended up sleeping in my rental car, and you know, I didn't know anyone in the city. And again, it was kind of like it was just like moving to the States all over again, you know, but as an adult and starting life over. So, but you know, like I said, I think growing up in New York City sort of prepared me to survive in those circumstances, and you know, it worked out for me.
And did you have a plan when you arrived in LA?
yeah, no plan. No, my only plan was to explore life and just kind of figure out what my path was supposed to be. You know, I was still in that age in my 20s where I hadn't quite grasped what my identity was. And when I started acting for the first time, things clicked very quickly, and it just made sense. I think because I was naturally a storyteller, and so I gravitated towards it. And my first 2 years, I was just having a grand old time doing educational theater, where I worked for several companies where we did shows for kids in LA school district. And a lot of them were either historical themed and educational themed, and some of them were sort of sketches that taught a different lesson about communication or safe sex or life of Martin Luther King Jr. I had one show where I had to play Martin Luther King Jr. with two other actors, and we had to sing, and it was about history of civil rights. And I mean, that cracks me up when I think about it. But it was great because, you know, they compensated us pretty well. We felt like we were teaching and doing something meaningful. So I was doing that for 2 years and having a great time, and doing plays. And and then I had no idea how film and television world worked, you know. And I happened to go to my first audition for TV, and it was for a show called JAG on CBS, which was about Navy lawyers. And I happened to get cast, and that's sort of how my career got started.
So one thing led to another after that, which brought you to the position in Heroes at some point.
Yeah.
And, you know, you were just talking about identity there a moment ago. You know, some might not really understand why, as a Korean American, you went for a Japanese role in Heroes. What was behind that? Was there anything in particular that motivated you to go for that?
Nothing particular, but story wise, it was a fantastic script. It was the first network pilot that I've read for. And pilots are basically television shows that are being created. And possibly picked up to series. And networks basically shoot about 100 of these and pick 10, you know, that they feel is promising. So, but the script just read like a movie. And there were people flying and walking through walls and traveling through time. And so that sort of really grabbed my attention from the beginning. And my father actually happened to study engineering in Japan and worked in Japan for 5 years. So when I was a kid, he would bring a lot of stuff back from Japan. I remember when he brought back the first Sony Walkman, and this was still, I want to say, you know, 1980 or something, you know. And you have to understand that Korea was still a third world country back then, so they've never heard of such a thing. And Japan was so far ahead of Korea, so that was really fascinating. So something about it just felt a little bit more familiar, you know, than not. So you know, after a month of auditioning and starting the show, NBC got a coach for me because I had to study language extensively. And That was probably the most difficult part, you know.
And just for those listeners who haven't watched the show, was your role actually, you spoke in Japanese in the role with subtitles, or were you speaking?
Yeah, I mean, my character sort of acted as a translator, so he spoke both English and Japanese, whereas my partner spoke no English in the beginning. And I took a semester of Japanese in college, but, you know, this was completely different, you know. I had to speak a lot of it, and which required a lot of work. So right from the start, it was just homework and memorizing and learning. And for me, it was important that I learn the language from, basically, I wanted to understand what I was saying rather than just kind of memorize what the dialect was, because I wanted the voices to come from the heart. And for that, you have to go a little bit deeper. So that took a lot of work, obviously, because you're now breaking things down, all the words into their foundations, and you're literally learning the language from scratch. So you can imagine, I mean, acting in general, you know, just takes preparation. But, you know, all the other people got to come on set and play. For me, I had to do about 40 hours of homework every week.
Wow.
In addition to that, so...
Yeah. But it was worth it, yeah.
Yeah, it was worth it. They actually talked about, because they knew that I was Korean, they talked about making Ando, which was my character. There's actually a lot of Koreans that grew up in Japan, that live in Japan, you know, right. They either came over from the war or whatnot. So they thought about maybe going into his heritage a little bit and show that he was possibly a Korean that grew up in Japan. I thought, which would have been an interesting sort of detail, but... You know, we have so many characters on this show that they just didn't have time to go into that kind of backstory.
Yeah. No, I can understand. So you learned to speak Japanese for that role in Heroes. Did you learn to DJ for your role in Akira's Hip Hop Shop?
Yeah, it's funny. Hip-hop is sort of like my first love when I was growing up in New York, you know. Groups like De La Soul, Tribe Called Quest, Gangstar.
Great groups.
Yeah. These groups are like fabric of my childhood. And so when that project came along, it was really rediscovering my first love again. And I didn't have to do table turning in the story. But it was just really cool to dive into that character. And just kind of the director bought me a book on history of hip-hop, and I just felt like I was reconnecting to a very passionate part from my childhood.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so another question about acting. Tell us about your first on-screen kiss. What are kisses, if you're an actor, are they any different to real life?
Oh, totally. First on-screen kiss... we had a love scene in Akira's Hip Hop Shop. There was a love scene in a first movie I did called Asian Stories, which was such a weird name for a movie. Heroes, I had to kiss a couple of characters. So I'm trying to think chronologically which came first. I think I had to do a short film where I had to do a love scene. So I've done it a few times now. It's never what you think it is. You know, it's never that glamorous. You know, you're surrounded by lights and microphones and crew members. And, you know, you have to stop and go. And sometimes you have to position your body and your lips and, you know, angle yourself. You know, sometimes you meet an actress and then, you know, that same day you have to pretend you're lovers where, you know, you're making love. So, it can be quite awkward. And, you know, I've worked with actresses that I was already friends with, and that, so, that was a lot easier because there was a comfort level and a level of trust. But sometimes you have to kind of just recreate a deep relationship pretty fast and, you know, and sell it.
Interesting. All right, so outside of acting, what are some of the areas people might not be familiar with that you're perhaps proud of, or, you know, very happy with what you've been doing?
I play for a basketball team in LA called Hollywood Knights, and we do USO tours for charity. So we go visit the American troops serving overseas, and play exhibition games and raise money for charity. So we had a tour in Italy, which was a lot of fun, a 4-city tour, and we also did a tour in Hawaii, which was awesome. And we went to the Air Force Base in Beale, which is right by Sacramento. So that's been great. And I'm also part of a organization called Creative Coalition, which bridges a lot of stuff between Hollywood and Washington. And so arts education reform is a huge thing. And Tim Daly is one of our chairmen, and HBO is a huge sponsor for us. So, yeah, and it seemed like a couple times a year I'm always brought out here for a different cause. You know, tonight going to a gala with this organization called APEX, and I believe the president is coming to speak before the gala. So, you know, I try to be active in the causes that I, you know, I believe in.
Now, you just mentioned Hollywood and Washington in the same sentence. We interviewed Daniel Day Kim about 3 months ago, who had been ranked in some magazine as sexiest man alive a few years ago. And I also read that you were once listed in Hollywood's 25th hottest actors. So I'd like to ask you a question we asked him back then.
Yeah.
Is it true, in your opinion, that Washington, D.C. is a Hollywood for ugly people?
You know, I've heard that many times before, and but, you know, I do see a lot of similarities. I mean, there are a lot of people who are close to power, and there are decisions and things that happen on a daily basis that feel mundane, yet have huge consequences down the line. So, you know, I found it interesting. I was here for a press conference where, you know, I'm involved with some green energy movements, and we unveiled a converted Prius that runs on LG that ended up getting 150 miles per gallon. So we're doing a press conference at Capitol Hill, and then the bell rings and all these senators and congresspeople have to go vote. And, you know, they treated it like they're going to go for a cup of coffee. Yeah, these are like votes that literally affect you and our lives, my life, you know, down the line, and make huge changes. So there's something interesting about that, you know. And, you know, obviously, you know, the two industries have a lot of there's a lot of networking. There's a lot of jockeying for positions of power. And so I see the similarities.
We often hear about actors becoming politicians. Arnold Schwarzenegger springs to mind. What about the other way around? Do you think there's much scope for that?
Well, you know, I think politicians have to do a lot of acting. I mean, right. Especially during campaigning, you know, and you see a lot of that. You know, they're in the public eye constantly, and you know, public speaking and debating, and that's an art and a craft, and I'm sure they've had to develop it. And you know, obviously, President Obama is someone who's very good at it. Yeah, it will be interesting to see somebody from the political world transition into the acting world. You know, I'm not sure if that's ever happened.
We'll have to do some research into that. So what are your thoughts on the Korean wave? Do you think it's something that's accurately portraying South Korea's soft power?
Yeah, I think the Korean wave is playing a big role, especially in the last 5 years. You see the music world and film and Korean entertainment really having this global influence. And I just find it really interesting, you know, that so much could come out from such a small country and really dominating Asia. So maybe we have a lot of, you know, artistry in our culture. And I think Korean people had to adapt to many changes throughout history. And perhaps, you know, that plays into the psyche of, you know, creating art. So I think it is interesting, and it is representative of the growth of Korea and, you know, how they've been growing economically and also, you know, as a country of power.
Mm-hmm. As you know, the US-ROK alliance has reached its high point under the Lee-Obama administrations. What do you think are the prospects for this important relationship?
You know, you mentioned the relationship between US and Korea, and there are a lot of collaborations happening, even between the film worlds. And Korean directors are now coming into Hollywood. Some of the actors are doing studio films, and I think that's very exciting. And, you know, when I visited Seoul a year ago for a publicity tour, I just found it really interesting because there was so much Western influence and it was so modernized, yet the culture from the prior generation was still catching up. So I felt this huge dichotomy of this new world still sort of dealing with the ways of the old. And I think in order for Korea to continually improve, they need to sort of force themselves to think outside the box, because their way of thinking has a very long history, and Koreans like to deal with, I think they're a very sensitive culture, so trust is a big thing, and they like to deal with people that are familiar, and they like to deal in ways that are familiar to them. So, in some ways, even though they're very adaptable, they're also resistant to change. You know? So I think Koreans are very good at seeing something and being able to sort of replicate them. But they need to go a step further and really originating or innovating things. And I think that's happening on the scientific world, the technological world. Mm-hmm. And I think I'd love to see that in the entertainment world as well.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed today's podcast with James Kyson Lee. You can download other episodes at our podcast website, which you can find at keia.podbean.com. That's keia.podbean.com. We'd also really appreciate if you could leave us some feedback using the comment system on either the Podbean website or directly on our iTunes page. If you'd like to suggest a candidate or topic for a future episode, be sure to drop me an email at ocarroll@keia.org. That's ocarroll@keia.org. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you can join us next time.